I'm proud to be a Jew, but that's way too Jewish for me.
Shalom, and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together today of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning on Two Jewish is Professor Andrew Pessin, co-editor of Anti-Zionism on Campus, the University, Free Speech, and BDS. We'll also have visits from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, our Two Jewish maven on Israel, Amir Eden, and our Shinshinim, Chen Denachi, and Tamir Shakuri. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Two Jewish.
Shalom. There was pretty big news about the Middle East last week, with President Trump ending the Iran nuclear deal as it has been since 2015. And we will talk about that during our News of Jews Around the World a little later in this Two Jewish show. But the other big Middle East news is that this coming week, the U.S. Embassy in Israel will officially move to Jerusalem from Tel Aviv. As we have said previously on Two Jewish, Jerusalem has been the actual capital of Israel since the beginning of the nation some 70 years ago, and the embassy should always have been there. The location of the U.S. Embassy itself and that of Israel's Knesset building and all of its government ministries, well, they're all in Western Jerusalem on land that has always been Israel by all international standards. This move is simply something that should have taken place long ago, as so many previous U.S. presidents have promised but never delivered. It's about time. And while so far only two other nations, Guatemala and Paraguay, have followed the U.S. lead, more may make the move shortly. So what does it mean beyond the obvious fact that it recognizes fact over fantasy in Middle East politics, which is frequently not the case? Well, first, it does not mean that a two-state solution, Israel and Palestine, is now off the table or somehow impossible. In spite of Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas's recent anti-Israel and anti-Semitic rantings, and the triumphant statements of some in Israel about the embassy move, there is nothing here that prevents a Palestinian state with some part of East Jerusalem as its capital eventually being created. This is just a symbolic move. It doesn't signify anything really beyond the fact that some preposterous bad habits in the region can change without the world coming to an end, or in fact being in any serious way damaged. Now, in spite of what you may hear elsewhere, it is true that Israel right now is strategically stronger than it has ever been. Its legitimacy is more widely recognized and accepted than ever before, and Israel enjoys warming relationships with a range of Arab states, from Saudi Arabia to Egypt to Jordan to various Gulf states. These are very welcome developments. Yet, however good that feels, the demographic dilemmas of how Israel can possibly maintain both its Jewish and democratic character while controlling the West Bank and its huge Palestinian population, well, those problems haven't changed at all. Sooner or later, and God only knows when this will actually happen, but it will someday, Israel will agree that most of the West Bank will be used as the territorial basis for a future Palestinian state. That does not mean the current Palestinian leadership can manage that. Abbas's ridiculous comments last week demonstrated it again. But it does mean that this new location in Jerusalem for the American embassy and that of other nations is simply a step towards recognizing reality. That is a healthy act in a part of the world that needs pragmatism and honesty in its politics. To play us in this morning, here's past Two Jewish guest Matisyahu's reggae version of Jerusalem, Yerushalayim, the city we've been talking about this morning. If I forget you, may my right hand forget itself, from the Psalms and Matisyahu.
Jerusalem, if I forget you, fire not gonna come from it. Jerusalem, if I forget you, forget what it's supposed to do. In the ancient days, we will return with no delay. Picking
spoils on our way. We've been traveling from state to state, and them don't understand what they say. 3,000 years with no place to be, and them want me to give up my milk and honey. Don't you see, it's not about the land or the sea, not the country, but the dwelling of His Majesty. Jerusalem, if I forget you, fire not gonna come from it on. Jerusalem, if I forget you, let my right hand forget what it's supposed to do. Jerusalem, if I forget you, fire not gonna come from it on. Jerusalem, if I forget you, let my right hand forget what it's supposed to do. Rebuild the temple and the crown of glory. Years gone by, about 60, burned in the Yemen in the century. And I guess try to choke, but they couldn't choke me. But that night down, I will not fall asleep. And I'm come overseas, yes, they're trying to be free. Erase the demons out of our memory. Change your name and your identity. Afraid of the truth and the dark history. Why is everybody always chasing we? Cut off the roots of your family tree. Don't you know that's not the way to be? Jerusalem, if I forget you, fire not gonna come from it. Jerusalem, if I forget you, let my right hand forget what it's supposed to do. Jerusalem, if I forget you, fire not gonna come from it. Jerusalem, if I forget you, let my right hand forget what it's supposed to do. Caught up in these ways and our world's gone crazy. Them don't know it's just a phase. Case of the Simon Says, if I forget the truth, then my words won't penetrate. Babylon burning in the place, can't see through the case. Chop down all of them dirty ways. That's the price that you pay for selling lies to the youth. No way, not okay. Oh, no way, not okay. Hey. Ain't no one gonna break my stride. Ain't no one gonna hold me down. Jerusalem, if I forget you, fire not gonna come from it. Jerusalem, if I forget you, let my right hand forget what it's supposed to do. Jerusalem, if I forget you, fire not gonna come from it. Jerusalem, if I forget you, let my right hand forget what it's supposed to do. Jerusalem.
That was reggae singer Matis Yahu singing of Jerusalem, which will be very much in the news this coming week. Our guest this morning, Andrew Pessin, is the co-editor of a new book on an increasingly important topic, Anti-Zionism and the Suppression of Free Speech, on the subject of Israel. Learn the latest developments in the BDS movement and the challenges faculty and students face on campuses all around the world when we come back in a moment here on Too Jewish.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun. A place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol. The best games in town. Amazing dining and top-flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball. Enterprise of the Pascua-Yaqui Tribe.
We are delighted to welcome to Too Jewish our guest this morning. Professor Andrew Pessin is the co-editor with Doron Ben-Attar of the new book Anti-Zionism on Campus, the University, Free Speech, and BDS, an outstanding volume that chronicles the reality and situation of both the BDS movement itself and the situation of anti-Zionism on campus in America today. Good morning and welcome to Too Jewish.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
It seems like a silly question because this has been an important issue for a while, but why is this coming out now?
Why is the book coming out now?
Yes.
Well, the book has been a number of years in the making. The problems trace back a good 10-15 years at least, to be sure, but there's no question in the past 5 years that the anti-Israel movement, combined with other anti-Semitic elements, in my opinion, has just taken their game up a notch. And as a result of an increased flurry of activity in the past 5 years, this generated a large number of incidents and narratives that became the subject matter of the book.
You make a really fascinating point in your introduction about the development of Students for Justice in Palestine and the choices that were made that it be a secular organization that supposedly supports human rights. Can you talk about that a little bit?
So the genius behind the movement is that they frame themselves as essentially promoting social justice and human rights. And, of course, who's against those? Nobody, at least officially. Nobody would come out and be against those. So it sounds great. And there's certainly room to argue for the improvement of the welfare of the Palestinians in the context of the Middle East conflict, etc. But what they've managed to do is really turn what is ultimately an anti-Semitic, Israel-hating attitude, the desire to not to promote Palestinians, but actually to destroy Israel. They've managed to cover that under this sort of umbrella of being a human rights endeavor. And the reality is it isn't. This group is far more interested in destroying Israel than in building up anything positive. They are actually demonstrably not interested in the welfare of Palestinians in general. They're only interested in Palestinian welfare insofar as that would promote destroying Israel. So they're really, in the end, a hate group driven by a hate agenda, but operating under the banner of human rights and social justice. And what that's allowed is a lot of what I think of, trying to think well of people, sort of well-intentioned, not particularly well-informed college students who care about social justice and human rights, and rightfully so. It's allowed them to sort of be swept up in this movement, not fully realizing, I think, not fully appreciating the degree to which they are really participating in an anti-Jewish, anti-Israel movement as opposed to a social justice movement. So in portraying themselves as a secular human rights organization, they've really managed to provide incredibly effective cover for what is really a hate agenda.
Fascinating. And we'll address that more deeply and many other issues of anti-Zionism on campus when we return with Andrew Pessin in just a moment here on Too Jewish. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or kvel, please email us at TooJewishRadio18@gmail.com. That's TOOJewishRadio18@gmail. Or visit our website at TooJewishRadio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website, streaming us from there or downloading us from the Apple iTunes Store as a very popular Jewish podcast, top 10 in America, according to Moment magazine. We're celebrating the 70th birthday of the State of Israel this spring, and as part of the huge celebration, Too Jewish includes spots from both our Israeli Shin Shinim and our Maven on Israel. We welcome our Maven on Israel, Amir Eden, head of the Weintraub Israel Center. Boker Tov, Amir.
Boker Tov, Rabbi.
Israeli Arabs, or Arab Israelis, take your pick, the terms are both used.
Sure.
People don't, I think, totally understand. We think, oh, everybody in Israel is Jewish, Kulanu Yehudim, and so on and so forth.
Right.
And that's true for 75% of the population.
Right.
But then there's a very large minority, a significant minority, that are Israeli citizens with essentially full rights, but they're Arabs, mostly Muslim, some Christians.
Right. So far what you said is correct.
Okay, so far I'm not wrong. Explain a little bit about the status of Israeli Arabs,
right,
and both the legal status and then the right, unofficial situation, if you will.
Right. Okay. So obviously there's a big group. As you said, the Arabs who are Muslims and the Arabs who are Christians, and there are those who define themselves as Israelis and those who define themselves as Palestinians, those who actually live within what you call the Green Line,
right,
or those who live in Judea, Samaria, and obviously Gaza, it's a different story.
Or East Jerusalem also. Right.
Right, and Jerusalem, but there's Jerusalem, correct, East Jerusalem. So basically, if you look at the country, and you have a lot of cities that you just have people living in the city. So if it's Haifa, if it's Akko, if it's Jaffa, Nazareth. So you have combined. You have Jews living there. You have Muslims living there. They play on the same sports teams. They go to the same hospitals. They go on the same buses. And it's not about, my bus, your bus. It's not about you sit here or you sit there. You sit everywhere. And if you want to go to college, you go to college. It's the same college. You graduate from the college as a lawyer and as a doctor. You can work everywhere. So it's sometimes very difficult when I have any discussion with someone who's never been in Israel, and they say, "What do you mean?" And they have those assumptions and the information which is just incorrect. I was born in Beersheba. My mom gave birth when someone else next to her was a Muslim giving birth.
Right. And same hospital, same words.
Of course.
Same,
and right. when I go to Israel and I go to
Lux. They didn't mix up the babies by any chance.
Who knows, huh? I'll speak Arabic in a second. But the thing is that when I go to Israel and I go a lot with students and I lead trips, I led a lot of trips, you know, we go there. And let's say there's a kid who needs medical attention. We go to a hospital, any hospital, right? So many times the doctors were Arabs, were Muslims, you know. So anything, you know, you look at investigations against public figures.
Yeah, the police.
You know, there could be a president of Israel, the prime minister of Israel, a parliament member. You know, there could be Arabs. You know,
people doing investigations of, let's say, theoretically, Mr. Netanyahu, for example, judges,
you know, Supreme judges. Court. Right. I mean, people don't understand that. They don't realize that, and that's a shame.
It is fascinating. Maybe next week we'll talk a little bit about both, continue this, and then talk a little bit about the status differences or the school differences a little bit.
Sure.
Thanks so much, Amir. We'll talk next week.
You're welcome.
We welcome one of our Shin Shinim, Chen Dinachi, wonderful representative of the Weintraub Israel Center here in America. Chen, you're spending your Shnat Sherut, that's where the term Shin Shinim comes from, your year of service to the country here in America, representing Israel extraordinarily well, working around the clock 7 days a week, even when you're not supposed to. Please explain, you graduated from high school. Now, for most Americans, the next step is college or junior college, you know, that's what's expected. And if you don't do that, then you go to work and hope to go to college. That's not how it works for Israelis. Can you explain the progression that pretty much every high school graduate goes through?
Yeah, thank you. So when you graduate from high school, you either do a Shnat Shirut, so like a year of service, like I'm doing, but there's like many other programs, or you can choose to go to Mechina, which is like a preparation year for the army. So it's like kind of a boarding school with a lot of people, and you learn philosophy and gender and leadership and kind of just evolve. It's another type of program, or you can go straight to the army. If you chose to do one of the other programs, then the following year you will join the army. In the army, there's many different positions. For boys, the standard is 3 years, and for girls, 2 years. If you choose to do something extraordinary, like a special unit or to be an officer, you usually need to commit for a little more time than that. For example,
like 5 years?
Or yeah, so
pilots,
an officer,
maybe even more.
Pilots is like 7 years.
Right, right.
But like in addition, so it's like 10 years.
In addition to the 3 years.
It's unbelievable.
So it's a 10-year commitment to be an Israeli pilot, right?
Yeah. But then like there's just units that are special. Like my brother's unit like makes him commit for 4 years.
Right. There's certain elite units like Sayeret Matkal or the Golani Brigade.
Yes, Sayeret Matkal I think is even like 6.
Yeah.
And then, but the standard is 2 years for girls, 3 years for boys. And then when you finish that, you would think you would go to college. But no, Israelis now wore green for the last 2-3 years, and we want to travel. So 90% of Israelis usually do a post-army trip, like a big long backpacking trip, either in South America or in the Far East or in India, usually in groups. And it's usually like a really long, like 6 months trip. And then when they're done, then you can start thinking about college, SATs, all of those fun stuff by the time you're like, what, 24?
Well, let's say you start at 18, you do a Shnat Sherut, like you're doing, you'll be 19 when you go in the army. You spend 2 years in the army, that makes you 21. You spend 6 months to a year, unless you commit to an
You have to
unit.
Work also before your trip, usually.
To save the money for the trip. So that might be 6 months or a year or even longer, depending how much you can save. So you might be 21 or 22 by the time you do your trip.
Yeah.
If you're a girl and a year older, if you're a boy.
Uh-huh.
And then you come back. So you're right, like 22 or 23. Then you go to college.
You don't even. You start like your psychometric, which is like our SATs.
Right.
You start studying for it. It's like a 5 month course. And then you take it. And then you need to like apply, and then you get in, and then you start studying. Like, it's such a long process. Israelis start their life so much later. Like, it's really weird for me to see like 26-year-old doctors here. Like, how?
Right.
Like,
how could that be?
26, I just came back from Cambodia.
Right. right. I'm thinking about which college I'm going to, not you know, what my residency is going to be in.
Yeah.
So it's a different process, and Israelis, by their nature, when they get to college, are, I think, more mature and more serious. They've gone through a lot more in life. Well, it's an exciting prospect, even if it's a long one. Thanks so much, Chaim. We'll talk
Thank
next
you.
Week.
Thank you.
The Boy Scouts of America have gone through many changes over the last 5 years, and you may not know about them. The Boy Scouts now include boys who are members of the LGBT community and leaders from the LGBT community. Just last year, a pilot program for boys 5 years old and in kindergarten was added, and a family program for girls 5 through 9 years old who can now join Cub Scouts. A key Boy Scout law says a scout is reverent, and duty to God is now a component for scout rank. Interfaith prayer is used whenever members of multiple faiths are present. In the early 70s, some Jewish organizations dropped sponsorship of scouting because of the lack of inclusion, but it's time for the Jewish community to return to its support for this great organization. Judaism shares principles that are represented and taught by the Boy Scouts of America. Scouting's a great place to inculcate good values and a shared philosophy, develop better adjusted and contributing young people who will become future leaders. Scouting is more than camping. It's a variety of activities promoting physical and mental health and emotional growth. Scouting schedules activities so as not to interfere with religious and other family activities and to include other members of the nuclear family. Scouting's an enhancement of religious, communal, and familial life. And that's true from the youngest level of scouting. Currently, only one unit chartered by a Jewish organization, PAC 613 in Tucson, exists in the state of Arizona. If you are in the Tucson area, contact Herb at Shofarman, S-H-O-F-A-R-M-A-N, at AOL.com, or call the Catalina Council at 520-750-0385. That's 750-0385. New members are very welcome in the scouting family. Scouting's there for all members, in good times and bad, helping in every way. Contact the Scouting Council in your area. Go to www.beascout.org or www.my.scouting.org. Ask your local council if they have a Jewish committee on scouting who can come to your synagogue or organization and see if scouting is just the thing to further your mission to the community. You can also contact the National Jewish Committee on Scouting, www.jewishscouting.org. Scouting is great for you and your family. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
I should say buenos dias. We've been talking about Spain and the Jewish community of Spain, well, really the Jewish history, the great Jewish heritage of Spain. And
more specifically of one little corner of Spain, Andalusia.
One little corner of Spain, Cordoba, which was a great Jewish place, although really it's almost exclusively a historical place. There's not a huge Jewish community there now.
Yeah, not in any of these cities. Not really anywhere in Spain is there a huge... There's an active community in Barcelona and in Madrid but
right.
It's really, you know, newcomers. It's not people with deep roots there.
Right.
So let's come back to this network of Jewish sites and the attempt by Spanish, more private industry really than government, to drum up Jewish tourism. It is a governmental initiative to offer people who are demonstrably of Spanish origin citizenship and passports and the right to live there and vote and all that. Very few Jews have actually taken the government of Spain up on this. And part of that is due to concerns about the extent to which they really would be welcome and how Spaniards today feel about Jews.
Part of it is also the economic condition of Spain itself is a little
not shaky. A real strong economy, exactly. But what I found the most interesting, and part of the story you've heard before, when I lived and worked in Sofia, Bulgaria, one of my best friends in the diplomatic community was my exact counterpart, the number two in the embassy of Spain. He was a much younger guy than I, who had done a year or maybe even two of high school in L.A. So his English was fluent. He felt very comfortable with Americans.
In spite of being in Los Angeles, his English was fluent.
Right.
Amazing.
His wife was the same way, and I spent a lot of time with these two. So like the rest of us diplomats in Sofia, during the winter, there were no fresh fruits and vegetables. You had to drive over the mountains into northern Greece, and the nearest big city is Thessaloniki, where there are pleasant hotels and seaside cafes and all that. Even in the winter, it's a lovely place to visit. So this Spanish couple went at least once or twice a month to buy fruits and vegetables, and they found a deli that also had like dried fruits and nuts and olive oil and stuff like that, which was a little ma and pa shop where, to their great surprise, the ma and pa were speaking like 15th century Spanish, as they called it. They were speaking the Spanish of Cervantes. And yeah, we couldn't believe it.
Yeah, it was Ladino.
And, well, yeah, but they had no idea why.
Ah.
And these are highly educated Spaniards who live overseas and who regularly visit one of the great Ladino-speaking cities of Europe. And they didn't have a clue. So I said, do you guys really not know why this couple speaks the Spanish of Cervantes? No. I explained to them. And then I subsequently learned from them, and it was confirmed by other sources independently, that the Spanish school curriculum makes absolutely no mention of the history of the Jews of Spain or the expulsion or the Inquisition or any of this stuff. So most Spanish people, unless they have some personal connection to Jewish friends like me, have no idea that there's a Ladino-speaking community in the world and that Spanish Jews were exiled to Turkey and Greece and other points in the Balkans. And it comes as a shock to them. Then I learned subsequently that the Spanish curriculum is the same vis-a-vis other minorities as well, like the treatment of the Basques historically, completely overlooked in the Spanish curriculum. It's like none of these things happened.
Fascinating. Nothing good about it. I should note that a lot of people think that something like 10 or 15% of the people of Spain are descended directly from Jews, and it might be higher than that, and yet no mention whatsoever of that heritage in their curriculum.
Right.
Something to work towards. Thanks so much, Tom. We'll talk next week.
I look forward to it.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. Mr. and Mrs. Greenberg go to see Hamilton on Broadway. This is still the most sold-out show of all, and scalpers are getting very rich on the tickets. The Greenbergs luck into third-row center seats. Then they notice that in the row behind them, there's an empty seat. Intermission comes. Still, nobody is sitting there. Mrs. Greenberg, you know, being a little nosy, turns to the woman sitting next to the empty seat and asks, "Pardon me, this is such a sold-out show. We're wondering if you know why that seat is empty." The woman answers, "That's my late husband's seat." Mrs. Greenberg is horrified at her own chutzpah and apologizes profusely for being so insensitive. But a few minutes later, she turns around again. "I don't mean to be rude or anything. This is an incredibly hard show to get into. Surely you must have a friend or relative who wanted to come and see the show?" The woman answers, "Oh, yes," and explains, "But they're all at the funeral." That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Too Jewish just for you. You should live and be well. And now a word of Torah. This week we read the Torah portion of Bamidbar, first in the book of Numbers, which is given its name for the census that occupies a good part of the beginning of the Torah portion. Superficially, it's just a listing of names and numbers, not a very interesting text for study or inspiration. But it also teaches us a primary lesson. Every human being counts in God's eyes, and should similarly count in our eyes as well. The notion that every person counts is part of our tradition in many ways, from the requirement that we need 10 Jewish adults for a minyan, to the requirement that we must view every other person as a tzelem Elohim, an image of God, no different from ourselves in holiness. The Talmud teaches that one who saves a single life is accorded the merit of having saved the whole world. Each of us is counted because we all count. Paradoxically, even counting itself can be transformed into an affirmation of sanctity. When we do the tabulation that lets us know we have the 10 required for a minyan, traditionally we don't count by numbers, since that would devalue each human being into being a mere digit. Instead, we find a verse from the Bible that has 10 words, and work our way through it until we've completed the passage, thus making every member of that accounting into part of a holy sentence. In a world of numbers, many of them grim, it is comforting to realize that we are each much more than the sum of our parts. No matter how quantified and digitized, our lives become otherwise. In Judaism, we matter. The Hebrew name for this portion and the book is Bamidbar. That means not numbers, but in the wilderness. And while the name comes from the first words of the book, it has a greater resonance and meaning than just that. Every time we Jews seek inspiration, it seems we must head out into the desert. That was true of Abraham and Jacob. It's certainly true of Moses. And after the Exodus, it's true as well for the whole people of Israel, who wander for 40 years in the wilderness of Sinai, the Midbar Sinai, seeking God and revelation. Why must we head out into nothingness in order to find truth? Perhaps it's simply because our own lives are so filled with complication and complexities, most of which are truly unimportant. But until we leave behind the convenience of home, until we divest ourselves of our comforts and conceits, we are unable to really understand what truly matters. Faith blooms freely in the desert, for there is nothing to prevent a person from seeing the world as it really is, coming to understand God's amazing role in it as creator and maker of covenants. You too can find God in the wilderness, and this is just as true in the Sonoran Desert as it was in the Sinai Desert for our ancestors. We simply need to look for God away from all the complications of our daily lives. The poet asks, "Must we enter the desert to hear your voice, God?" And to that we can answer, "Maybe." When we return on To Jewish, our guest, Professor Andrew Pessin, will update us on the most recent developments in the struggle with the BDS movement, anti-Zionism, and the suppression of free speech on college campuses, and tell us about his new book on the subject. All that when we return in a moment here on To Jewish.
We continue with our To Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
In a dramatic announcement last week, President Donald Trump withdrew American participation in the nuclear agreement with Iran, effectively ending it. "I announced today that the U.S. will withdraw from the Iran nuclear deal," Trump said, speaking at the White House. "I'll sign a presidential memorandum to reinstate nuclear sanctions on the Iranian regime." The sanctions Trump reinstated target countries, businesses, and individuals who deal with Iran's financial system. Trump's decision comes after a full court press by three major European nations who are also party to the 2015 deal, urging him not to pull out. In recent weeks, French President Emmanuel Macron, a friend of Trump's, German Chancellor Angela Merkel, and British Foreign Secretary Boris Johnson have all visited Washington to try and persuade Trump to stay in the nuclear deal. The original deal traded sanctions relief for Iran's rollback of its nuclear program. Trump had said that he might stay in the deal if it could be renegotiated to remove the sunset clauses that allow Iran to resume some enrichment of fissile material within a decade. Trump also wants a tougher inspections regime and a missile testing ban added into the deal. European allies say reopening the deal now, particularly in relation to the sunset clauses, is impossible, especially given the adamant opposition of the other parties to the deal, Iran, Russia, and China. Instead, the Europeans offer to increase pressure on Iran in other arenas, including new sanctions targeting its missile testing, and committing to put pressure on Iran as the sunset clauses loom to extend bans on enrichment. But Trump rejected those overtures. "This was a one-sided deal that should never have been made," he said. Israel and Saudi Arabia have been U.S. allies pressing for a pullout from the deal. Israeli Prime Minister Bibi Netanyahu last week unveiled documents showing that before the 2015 deal, Iran hid the breadth of its nuclear weapons development. Trump credited Netanyahu's presentation in making his decision. "We have definitive proof that this promise was a lie," Trump said, referring to Iran's pledge to roll back its nuclear program. "It is clear to me we cannot prevent an Iranian nuclear bomb under the decaying and rotten structure of the current agreement," Trump said. "The Iran deal is defective at its core." Well, it's not clear what happens going forward. The Trump administration would have to put staff and mechanisms in place to monitor compliance with U.S. sanctions, a process that could take months, giving some leeway to renegotiate a deal. On the other hand, simply announcing the reimposition of sanctions will inhibit companies and countries from doing business with Iran, effectively crippling the nuclear deal almost immediately. In tragic news last week, Rabbi Aaron Pankin, the president of Hebrew Union College, who led the Reform Movement Seminary, HUCJAR, since 2014, and a past guest of Two Jewish, was killed while piloting a small aircraft near Wawayanda, New York, close to the New Jersey border. A passenger, Frank Reese, a flight instructor, was injured in the crash. The cause is under investigation by the Federal Aviation Administration and the National Transportation Safety Board. Pankin was an experienced, licensed pilot. Prior to serving as HUC president, the native New Yorker held senior positions at the school, including vice president for strategic initiatives, dean of the New York campus, and dean of students. Provost Michael Marmer said the school had yet to make succession plans, but would have an announcement regarding the issue in coming days. HUC held memorial services on all of its campuses and live-streamed Aaron Pankin's funeral last week. Gene Rosensaft, the HUC communications director, said that Rabbi Pankin was passionate about Israel, working to improve ties between American Jews and the Jewish state and to strengthen Reform Judaism there. This was the mission of his life. He really lived it with every fiber of his being, she said. Aaron Pankin was a fine Talmud scholar, not typical of Reform rabbis or even Reform professors. He came from a strong scientific background, also unusual among rabbis of any denomination. Pankin was a highly respected figure both within the Reform movement and in the Jewish world more broadly for his knowledge, positive energy, and effectiveness. Rabbi Aaron Pankin was 52 years old. Zecher Tzadik Livracha. May his memory be a blessing. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews Round the World. We welcome back to Two Jewish This Morning, Professor Andrew Pessin. He's professor of philosophy at Connecticut College and campus peer editor of the Allgemeiner. He's the co-author with, or co-editor, I should say, with Doron Ben-Attar of the new book Anti-Zionism on Campus, the University, Free Speech, and BDS. You made the point earlier in the show that the SJP, the Students for Justice in Palestine movement, is really a hate group, and that the key goal is not human rights for Palestinians, but literally the destruction of Israel. Can you amplify that a little bit?
Sure. So, you know, if a group is really in support of the, I don't know, the needs and the rights of a certain population, you would expect a certain set of behaviors, namely wherever that population is infringed or oppressed or suppressed, etc., you speak up and you act out. And yet it's sort of demonstrably the case that groups like SJP, the campus arms of the anti-Israel movement, essentially express no concern about Palestinians except insofar as Israel can be blamed for the problem. So, for example, Palestinians have been suffering horribly in Syria. Something like 3,000 have been killed over the past few years in Syria. Many have fled. Many are refugees. You never hear a word from SJP about the situation in Syria for the Palestinians. Palestinians in Lebanon are essentially subject to an actual apartheid regime. There are all sorts of laws restricting where Palestinians can live. They're essentially restricted to a handful of camps. There are laws restricting them from purchasing property, purchasing homes, taking on certain types of jobs or professions, etc. And indeed, recently, one of the major camps of Palestinians in Lebanon built a security wall around the entire thing. It's literally a prison,
yeah.
Basically literally a prison.
Yeah.
You never hear a single word from SJP about that situation. You will hear endlessly about SJP complaining about the Israeli blockade on Gaza. There's not a word about the fact that the restrictions on Gaza due to Egypt on the southern part of Gaza are far more restrictive and constraining. They're basically, the crossings have been open like 20 days in the last 2 or 3 years on the Egyptian side, whereas the crossings into Israel see a tremendous amount of truck traffic, hundreds of tons of goods going in and out every week, etc. Yes, it's restricting military use materials, but everything else goes in and out through Israel. So you never see SJP complaining about Egypt. It's only about Israel. And then, of course, on top of that, they regularly misrepresent and straightforwardly lie about Israel's alleged misdeeds. So, you know, the point is they really don't care about Palestinians, where Palestinians are actively and actually suffering due to no fault of their own. They only care about attacking Israel.
Campus environment had become, I think, nearly toxic for anybody who supported Israel for a while. There's been a pushback. Can you talk about that? Because some of that does emerge in the book as well.
Yeah, so in some respects, it's important to maintain context. So there's something like 4,000 accredited colleges and universities in the United States, and the anti-Israel activity we see is in the end on a relatively small percentage of them. So, I don't know, 100 or 150 out of 4,000. So, you know, you tend not to hear about the campuses that are quiet, because what makes the news is obviously...
Because they're quiet, so...
Because they're quiet, exactly. Yeah. And the reality is, too, there's a wonderful organization called the Israel on Campus Coalition, ICC, which tracks all sorts of incidents, both pro-Israel and anti-Israel incidents on many of these campuses, and finds that if you add up the numbers, there's actually more pro-Israel events and lectures and activities on campuses than there are anti-Israel. So, you know, in that context, that's positive. However, where the activity is negative, it's very negative, and it's very extreme, and it tends to be on really the major campuses on the East and West Coasts, and some of the major ones in the Midwest, tends to be basically where there are larger populations of Jewish students is where the harshest, most persistent anti-Israel activity is, which strongly suggests that this activity isn't so much targeting Israel, because to be honest, Israel has been prospering and flourishing over the past 15 years, let's say, since the BDS movement has gotten going. It's actually targeting the Jewish students on these campuses. It's harassing them, intimidating them, etc. So that seems to be the main focus. Now, the question that started a moment ago was about the pushback, and I do think in the last few years, pushback is happening. There are a number of great organizations that themselves are upping their game, so to speak, whether it's ICC is very active, the Maccabees got going a few years ago, Stand With Us does a tremendous amount of work, is present on a lot of campuses. So I do think that increasing numbers of these Jewish students are feeling really fed up with the oppressive and really, in times, threatening atmosphere that they're experiencing. So they are pushing back, and a new campus group started a couple of years ago called Students Supporting Israel, SSI. It started at the University of Minnesota, and I don't know how many campuses they're on now, but at least several dozen, maybe more than that. And they're trying to sort of be aggressively pro-Israel, and I mean that in the good sense. Up to a few years ago, most Jewish or pro-Israel students were always on the defensive. A BDS proposal would spring up in a student government. They'd have like 3 days to basically go in and argue that Israel is not the evil empire, and they were typically underprepared and always on the defense. And when you're on the defense, you always sound hollow. The more you try to argue that you know, your side's not evil, the more you sound like you're evil. So, but SSI has a different philosophy. They are being much more aggressively pro-Israel, and like I said, they're spreading quickly and really doing some wonderful things. So pushback has begun. Until the last few days, I was feeling actually optimistic that maybe even the tide is turning. This is a sort of subjective thing, but the last few days have been rough if you've been following the campus scene. But by the tide may be turning, so I'm optimistic in the long run that that the pro-Israel side will prevail.
I do follow these events. By the way, Roz Rothstein of Stand With Us is a past guest of Too Jewish. We've had a variety of other people on.
Let me recommend that you get Ilan Sinelkov, who's the leader of Students Supporting Israel. He'd be a wonderful guest.
I will do so. Your recommendation. I'm not sure everybody still understands the BDS movement, but you made an excellent point. It's the Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions movement, and they've worked very hard to get universities to remove any investment or connection to any companies that do business with Israel. Started, with companies that did work in the West Bank or originally in Gaza. Now it's not really that. But the truth is it's had essentially no economic impact on Israel, which has, as you noted, flourished. But it's still extremely active, and I think people need to understand that it's not some neutral group working for Palestinian rights.
So if I can speak to that, if you look at the, you know, the concrete numbers, people do these studies, and if you look at some of the specific companies targeted by BDS on campus, like Caterpillar and G4S or something like that, most of these companies, their share prices, their stock prices have, you know, exploded over the last 10 years. They're all doing great. Israel's economy is basically doing great. So there's no impact there. But the BDS movement on campus knows that, and I think they're actually realistic. Their goal is not in the end, certainly not a reasonable one or realistic one, to harm Israel economically or pressure Israel to make changes. What they're in it actually for the long term, and they're quite explicit about that. Wherever there's a BDS campaign, and it doesn't even have to be a specific campaign like a student government resolution to boycott Israel, wherever there's aggressive anti-Israel activity, for example, Israeli apartheid weeks, which pop up on a whole bunch of campuses just over the past couple weeks, actually, in the spring, what happens is the students on that campus are subjected to weeks and weeks of just hate-filled anti-Israel propaganda. Most students want to just get on with their studies. They don't want to be involved either way, whether they're Jewish or not Jewish. But what's happening in the long term is more and more younger people who don't know a whole lot. I mean, it's a complicated conflict over there, and you have to know a lot of the history to understand it. And most of them have no interest and certainly no experience. But they come away at the end of each semester, at the end of each year, just hearing, you know, that Israel is genocidal, ethnic cleansing, human rights violations, violating international law. They hear it over and over again, and their default opinion and feelings towards Israel become incredibly negative. And what's going to happen is, you know, in 10 years and 20 years, this is the next generation of politicians and journalists and thought leaders, you know, and even artists, cultural figures, etc. They're trying, the BDS movement is trying to really change the next generation's opinions towards Israel, hoping and expecting that, you know, 20, 25 years from now, the United States Congress is not going to be so supportive of Israel as it has been traditionally. So they're in it for the long game, and that's where I think they're very, very effective. So they're ineffective in terms of actually putting any pressure on Israel economically right now. But in the long run, they might really change the American attitude towards Israel, and that is a serious danger.
I want to talk about freedom of speech on campus, freedom of conscience, which is so central to the whole academic enterprise. That is really challenged by both the BDS movement and the whole sort of anti-Zionism, really anti-Judaism movement. Can you explore that a little bit?
Oh, it's really stunning. I think, to put the point most clearly, the very thing that the BDS movement aims for is so antagonistic to the basic principles of the Western University that it's stunning to me that it's mostly only sort of the Jews who are protesting what's going on because they're the target of it. It really should be anyone who cares about the future of Western civilization. I'll make a really, really broad claim there. Anyone who cares about the state of the Western University should care. And I'll give one quick example. There's both bad news and good news from our perspective that comes out of McGill University in Canada. They've had a lot of anti-Israel activity there over the past few years. In the end, BDS was defeated there, and then basically they have a judicial board which issued a ruling that BDS was actually inconsistent with the constitution of the university, which governed principles of the university, primarily because it was understood that a university itself has to be, the institution has to be a neutral environment. If we care about the progress of knowledge, then we need divergent opinions and disagreements. That's crucial for the life of the university. But then the institution itself has to be a neutral ground where the individuals with different opinions can come and, you know, duke it out intellectually, so to speak. And what BDS is deliberately trying to do is to take over the institution and have the institution have an opinion that the university should condemn Israel, the university should endorse BDS, and that is just antagonistic to the whole point and purpose and mission of a university. So McGill University figured that out, and they issued this beautiful ruling a year or two ago. And I actually wrote a piece about it, and I'm just trying to spread this word because it's so important. So far, silence from other universities. But, you know, the hope is this clear-sighted document from McGill just expressing so clearly that the nature of the university would rule out the whole idea of the university endorsing BDS against anybody. It would be nice if that spread.
It would indeed. There's another interesting phenomenon, kind of commented on one of the essays about people who are fine scholars in other areas jumping into the anti-Israel, pro-Palestinian debate and being given immediate credence, even though they know nothing about it. And I think of people like the great linguist Noam Chomsky or Judith Butler, who've made names for themselves in other fields, now launching in on the Palestinian side and not without any expertise whatsoever, but being given some of that credence. Can you address that a little bit?
Yeah, so there's a couple of different levels to that. It's a fascinating phenomenon just from an intellectual perspective and a truly troubling one from, I would say, a moral perspective. Some people refer to this as Israel Derangement Syndrome, IDS, that certain people, and I would ultimately argue it comes from, like, you know, deep-rooted anti-Semitism or self-hatred.
Self-hating
if it's, you know,
Jews, yeah. Yeah, so the two examples I gave are both Jewish, but go ahead.
That's right. So it's the self-hatred Jews, and there's, you know, a whole history of analyzing that phenomenon. But there's something about Israel that many people, they lose their minds when it comes to Israel, and they lose the same scholarly objectivity that might make them great scholars in whatever their fields are. You know, Chomsky is famous in linguistics and
right.
Butler famous in gender studies and things like that. These are brilliant people. I've read a lot of both of their work, and yet when they come to writing about Israel, it's like a different mind is present, and it's disturbing, and it's, you know, fascinating. As far as expertise, actually, a lot of people do like to make that criticism. They say, you know, to Chomsky, you're the expert in linguistics, but what do you know about the Middle East? That particular objection doesn't move me all that much, partly from my own case. What happens when you get interested in something?
You mean as a philosopher, your expertise in the Middle East could fall into the same category?
No, exactly. But because I'm very interested in this issue, I've spent quite a bit of time. I study a lot. I've been to Israel several times. You know, I'm reading, and I may not have my PhD in this field, so I don't quite have those scholarly credentials. But I'm a person who's sort of trained as an academic who has sort of done some serious study of it. So, and Chomsky is very knowledgeable. Butler, I think, less so, just on that individual example.
Absolutely.
But a smart, academically trained person can develop expertise even if they don't
of
have
course.
Official credentials. So,
sure.
So that particular objection doesn't bother me that much. I have to look at the things they're saying, but that's when I get bothered, because then they swallow pro-Palestinian propaganda whole, and they dismiss anything Israelis ever say in their defense. And in doing that, they've just lost whatever intellectual integrity they might have in their normal fields of expertise. So that's the troubling thing.
The book is called Anti-Zionism on Campus, University Free Speech and BDS. If you want to know what's going on, not only on the campus in America, but in Canada, Australia, really around the world, South Africa, it's a great book, and it will catch you up and sometimes infuriate you, but also, I think, give you hope. I want to thank Andrew Pestner for a great visit here. Where else can people go to find out more about you, to find out more about the book?
So I do have a website, andrewpestner.com, and there's a lot more information about my work and this book to be found there.
Thanks so much. When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest and get a final musical play out.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun, a place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol. The best games in town, amazing dining, and top-flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball, Enterprise of the Pascua-Yaqui Tribe.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday. Our guest on Too Jewish will be Greg Schneider, Executive Vice President of the Claims Conference, on the new survey of Holocaust knowledge in the United States. And of course, listen to all of our podcasts on iTunes or at our TooJewishRadio.com website. Hear our Top 10 in America podcasts. Our playout this morning comes for the last week and a little more of the period of the counting of the Omer. Sheyabona Beis Hamikdash, from the Sfirah to Omer. May the temple be rebuilt speedily and soon, sung by cantor Yitzchak Meir Helfgott and played on violin by the immortal Yitzchak Perlman. My friends, may you have a good week, and a week, we pray, of peace.
Shibone beisami kedosh bimeirov yomenu yeirotzoin milchonechorotzoin yehi. Shibone beisami kedosh bimeirov yomenu lesein chelkenu vesoerosecho. Shibone. Mikdosh mimeirov yomenu yehi rotzoin milefonecho rotzoin yehi.
Sponsored by two Jewish radio programs, Tucson, Arizona.